Welcome to Conversations with Canadian Art Song Project, hosted by pianist Stephen Philcox and tenor Lawrence Williford.
This is Lawrence Williford, co-artistic director of Canadian Art Song Project. One of the most exciting things we get to do as CASP is the commissioning of new works and working with the creative team for a new premiere performance. Following their first few sessions together, Stephen Philcox sat down with composer Dean Bury and tenor Michael Colvin to talk about our latest commission, The Sea Variations, a cycle of seven songs which set poems by the 20th century Canadian poet E.J. Pratt. The Sea Variations by Dean Bury will be premiered in Toronto in mid-May 2019. This wide-ranging discussion was recorded in Stephen's studio on a warm spring afternoon, so you may hear the noises of Toronto traffic sneaking in through the open window. We hope you enjoy this interview and the following brief musical analysis of this new work.
Hello, and a warm welcome to our listeners. I'm Stephen Philcox, and I'm here today with Dean Bury, composer, and Michael Colvin, tenor. Welcome to you both. Let's just jump right in. Dean, you've written a new piece for Canadian Art Song Project. Maybe we could start by talking about how the collaboration came into being.
I think we met probably about almost 20 years ago, or,
yes,
or 18 years
exactly
ago
right.
or so,
yeah.
At the Canadian Opera Company.
All three of us.
Michael,
we
met at U of T, I think.
That's
we were
right.
at U of T together, right?
Before.
Yeah, exactly. And I think then when I saw you kind of move into this kind of field of the, you know, with Canadian Art Song Project and start promoting that, there was an immediate appeal there. I myself have spent a tremendous amount of time trying to get people to realize that opera is not this old-fashioned, dead art form, in a sense, working
yes.
a lot with young people. And so I was thrilled, you know, to see that Canadian Art Song Project was now kind of going to do that work in the art song field. Because
mm-hmm.
I think in some ways, traditionally, art song has fallen into that same sense with people that it's an old-fashioned, or it was an old-fashioned art form, in a sense. Clearly it isn't,
mm-hmm.
and it needed people to, you know, to promote that. So we talked, I think, right from the beginning of when you guys founded the organization about,
mm-hmm.
about, you know, doing something, and it just, my experience in kind of career and life, everything has got a lot to do, I think, with putting yourself in the right place and waiting for the right time, you know, and I think it was the right time for this, you know, this project to come along. You know, I grew up in Gander, Newfoundland. I jokingly tell people that I spent the first 18 years of my life trying to get away from Newfoundland and the rest of it trying to get back. And I think all the Newfoundlanders feel that way as well. Michael, you're married to a Newfoundland connection.
My wife Mary lived in Newfoundland for a while. She's originally from Edmonton, but she went to Memorial.
Right.
So
mm-hmm.
That's sort of, it's a rather tenuous connection to Newfoundland, but having been born in Ireland, I suppose one could say, partly, I'm a bit of a Newfoundlander in a way.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. So, you know, I've done so much Newfoundland work through my career. My first opera was an opera called Under the Earth, Vignettes of a War, which was about the Newfoundland Regiment in the First World War. I wrote a piece about the Viking arrival called The Vinland Traveler. I wrote The Mummer's Mask for Toronto Masked Theatre. I'm working on the opera Shauna Did It now with Tapestry
mm-hmm.
as well, too. So
mm-hmm.
I've always been drawn back, obviously, to the stories of Newfoundland. And I think, you know, with E.J. Pratt, I think when I really became very aware of him as a poet, I mean, I certainly knew of him, and I heard his work growing up, but I came and did my master's here at the University of Toronto, and of course, you walk every day by the E.J. Pratt Library, and I think it made me think a little bit more about who was this Newfoundlander who kind of had this big impact in Toronto. I suppose it mirrored my story a little bit as well, too, in the sense that I had left small town kind of Newfoundland to come to the big city. And was in this kind of like, not only the academic world as well, like E.J. Pratt, but also the artistic world, obviously, as a,
mm-hmm.
you know, he as a poet. I'd always wanted to do something with him and use, now I, as I mentioned before, like I write a lot of opera. I would say still probably 80% of my output is operatic. But I've always been wanting to get into kind of like a smaller form that still has an immense impact, you know.
Right.
So art song has always been, not to mention, and I think Michael, you did this at one time, I always have singers who have been in my operas coming up to me saying, I am doing this recital, do you have anything that I can sing, right? And I think it's high time that I have a little bit more, you know, for people to sing. So the idea was like always knocking around in my brain. Now another big issue, obviously, when you're writing music with text that you don't write yourself, is it in the public domain? Is this
right.
something that can be used,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Again, when I write my own pieces, that's not an issue.
Of course.
But it turns out that E.J. Pratt died in 1964, and in Canada, people have copyright for 50 years after the death of the poet. So, in fact, I would say around 2009, 2010 was the first time that I started poking around at U of T Press and just asking, what would I have to do? What would one have to do to get permission to set E.J. Pratt? And, the guy basically said, well, if you just wait until 2014,
yeah, right.
You had mentioned to me again that you were ready to move forward on a commission. And I thought, oh, we're in that space now.
Yeah.
As far as kind of these poems as well, too, Sea Variations is not, which is, I should mention, is kind of a cycle of poems as well, too.
Yes.
It's six poems that kind of fit together, so it that kind of made sense for a song cycle as well. But they're certainly not his best known work. Right around the time that my daughter Blythe was being born, in 2006, I went to the library and took out three collected volumes, which weighed about 40 pounds, of the collected works of E.J. Pratt. And I literally remember the night that my daughter was born, and I was sitting awake in the hospital in one of those recliner chairs while my wife was sleeping, reading to try to find the piece to do. And so, I mean, there's lots of wonderful work in his catalog, but something jumped out of this. I knew that I wanted it to be something connected with the sea, obviously.
Okay.
It's an E.J. Pratt
yeah.
thing. It's
yeah.
it's a me thing. So we have those connection together as well. But there was something about this series of poems that, again, the fact that it was a cycle suggested something about, you know, something that could become a song cycle.
I'm curious, Dean, as a composer, do you consider yourself as having kind of major influences, other composers, other artists, and maybe not necessarily even musicians, but that have kind of really kind of shaped you and that maybe even have a place kind of in the work that you've done around this setting?
I've always felt that good music is good music. And so mm-hmm. I could list, you know, classical composers or art music composers that are influences. I mean, a very obvious one as well, too, that will always come up is Benjamin Britten, of course.
Right.
And again,
yes.
I think it's got to do with where we grew up,
uh-huh.
the way we grew up. I don't necessarily consider myself a lot of time the most avant-garde composer. I don't mind there being a good tune now
yeah.
and then.
Yeah.
And I think that
neither do the singers. The singers like a good tune.
And I that comes from the fact that I play in a traditional Celtic band,
mm-hmm.
Three chord mm-hmm. songs, and I write musicals as well too, right? So
right.
I've in saying good music is good music, writing pop music and writing folk music and those things have always been a part of what I do as well. Certainly when I was in high school, I wanted to be Billy Joel.
Uh-huh.
You know,
yeah.
But I would say the one influence that it always comes back to is those great storytellers.
Yes, I was just going to say.
Right?
Yep.
Because I find that if I had to kind of label myself as something before even labeling myself as a composer or a librettist,
yeah.
it would be as a storyteller. You know, people will have that debate about programmatic music.
Mm-hmm.
I find it difficult to write anything that doesn't, if not tell a story, tell a feeling or a sentiment or something
yeah.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the big influences on me are the great storytellers, you know,
mm-hmm.
which would be Billy Joel or Benjamin Britten
yeah.
or Shakespeare or Tolkien. The influences on me is the people that are really good at telling stories.
Mm-hmm.
It's really cool to hear, sorry to interrupt, Steve,
no.
but it's really neat to hear you bring in contemporary people as well, like when you mentioned Billy Joel and stuff into the music,
mm-hmm.
because we so often hear that classical music is a dying art form, people,
mm-hmm.
some people will say. And it
mm-hmm.
clearly isn't. And I would say this piece that you've written has some of those sort of popular influences as well. And you can hear it. And it's fantastic as a performer
well,
to explore those.
Because I've done so much music for young people. That's kind of how I've made my name writing pieces like The Brothers Grimm or for the Canadian Opera Company or The Hobbit
yeah.
and Secret World of Og for Canadian Children's Opera Company. It's not just a focus on writing for young people, but also writing for new music audiences as well, too, right? You know, I have pieces that are done in Newfoundland, and I remember my Aunt Bonnie coming to see one of my operas And I wanted my aunt Bonnie to like the first opera that she'd ever seen, right? Mm. So there's a lot of different ways to connect with people that are new to the art form, or young people as well, too. And one way is, to write more popular styles of writing. I really try to write to make these pieces kind of penetrable. And something, if the music is not something that the listener is used to, then there's some, I suppose, which is why the storytelling and the programmatic aspect of it is so useful. Because you can write quite challenging music, but if they can, if it makes sense to them, if the idea behind it is clear, but there always has to be a way in for an audience.
I agree with you 100%. For sure. Can I tell a funny story, actually?
Yeah, please.
So I remember a couple of years ago, I approached Dean with a favorite children's book that I used to read to my kids called Dinosaurs Galore, and Dean's laughing, and I remember coming to him at that point and just thinking, and again, because you had done so much with the kids' stuff, the Isis and the Seven Scorpions and the Brothers Grimm, and I had thought this would be kind of an interesting song cycle. It was a series of sort of little poems, and I remember Dean at the time sort of saying, you know, I'm ready to move on to more serious stuff. And he, at that time, actually, I think you might even mention the E.J. Pratt poems to me. And that's why it's so awesome that this is happening, because I remember, I mean, we've known each other 20 plus years, and at various points we've talked about collaborating. So,
yeah, you know, and there, there was, it's funny that you mentioned that, because there were certainly points in my career that I kind of, it troubled me a little bit that I was pigeonholed as a children's writer, you know?
Yeah.
You know, the bottom line is, anytime I would feel troubled about that, I'd look at the fact that 150,000 kids the world over had seen the Brothers Grimm, and you feel that you really have made an impact.
And what, you're one of the most played composers in Canadian history.
Well, the Brothers Grimm, I
think. Yeah, I mean, that's...
At about 650...
That's what it is, most performed.
Performances, yeah. And that's a blessing.
Right.
You know, that's a blessing. And bottom line is, in this career, you've got to grab the opportunities you have and love them. And enjoy them, right? So I think I'll never stop writing for young people. Obviously, I've branched out in a lot of other areas as well too. But I'll never stop writing for young people because I love that audience. They're open. They're open to
and
the
they're
music,
honest, right?
You know?
They're so honest in terms of what they think.
Yeah.
You know, I think one of the things that intrigued us so much, Dean, about kind of approaching you for a song project was that you had written so much opera and that you were a composer who obviously had a real kinship with text, but hadn't kind of delved so much into this more intimate form. I'm wondering if opera and song are different for you in terms of how you kind of approach them as a composer, or maybe even what are some of the similarities, what are some of the differences?
That's a great question, actually. I would say that there's certainly more similarities than there are differences for me. But, you know, my background as well, too, is like when I graduated from high school, am I going to theater school and becoming an actor? Or am I going to music school and becoming... I was really, really involved in the theater world as well, which is, I think, why I ended up in opera, because it's a way for me to do both in a sense, right? All my work, even if it's kind of long and deep, it tends to be smaller scale, a lot of chamber opera.
Right, yes.
The piece that I have coming up is kind of one of the larger ones I've done. Mm-hmm. So, and with a piece like The Brothers Grimm, it's for five singers and a piano to throw in the back of a van, which is getting closer. It's somewhere between art song and opera in a sense, right?
Yes.
And I guess, again, the fact that to come back to the idea of storytelling, if I have a piano and a singer singing, inevitably it's going to be storytelling, which is kind of going to be kind of akin to opera. However, the great thing about writing art song is certainly, I mean, song cycles as well too do have an arc, but when you're thinking in an opera, you're playing a much longer game, and the development has to be teased out over a much longer time. Development arcs kind of happen over in a much grander scale. When I sat down to kind of start working on C variations, I got to like the 3-minute point at the end of the first song, and I thought, oh, I can end it now. That's it. That's the piece.
Right.
The next one, it might be 2 minutes, right? Uh-huh. And it's just this, it's just a joy. I think it's a joy to cut. And it doesn't mean that a small scale, quote unquote small scale piece like this can't have incredible depth.
Yes.
And the same emotion that you could find in a full opera.
Right.
It just works in kind of a smaller, airier medium, in a sense, you know, and it was liberating. In fact, I wrote this piece in the middle, took a break from the opera, wrote this piece, came back to the opera, and it was a great palate cleanser.
Oh, yeah.
Right. It was a great... Now, also very interesting because the other piece is also a Newfoundland story, but very much from an indigenous experience as well, too, right? One of the main characters in Shaun na Dtí is a Scottish Newfoundland guy. So to be working so much on that and then to kind of flip over to a different perspective, a much more colonial perspective, I suppose you could say in that sense. Leading into it, I was a little bit concerned because it was like, I've been living in this world, how do I make this transition? But in reality, what happened, it really actually ended up serving both pieces really well.
Dean, did the music just pour out of you in this cycle? Like, was it an easy piece to write?
It was a very easy piece to write. Yeah, exactly. And that's not always the case.
Yeah.
Sometimes, again, especially when you're on track and like writing a certain piece or a certain way, again, like a large scale opera, I was just afraid that it might be hard to shift gears. Mm-hmm. But this piece, again, because it talks so much about the faces of the ocean and the different styles and the different way the ocean appears and the different way we perceive the ocean as well, again, it just gets in your blood. If you're a Newfoundlander, it just gets in your blood. And that's one of the things that, every summer that I go back, I go down to Windmill Bight, which is this little kind of provincial park, but it's right on the northeast corner of Newfoundland. It's this incredibly beautiful beach that my mind always kind of drifts back to as well, too. And it's so much to do with the smells and the sounds. And again, like to talk about Benjamin Britten, and I know you guys have both done a lot of works by Britten. His music is infused with that as well, too.
Yeah.
All throughout this, I hear that in the music, the trickling water, and it's amazing, Dean. It really is. It's a pleasure to see.
Well, I think, like, you know, you asked about influences in Britten, and I think Britten is another great example of someone who writes definitely contemporary, fresh, new music, but yet connects an audience, connects people to it, you know? And ultimately, that's what I'm trying to do. Clarity is my credo, I think, in a sense, right? Because I feel like you can write the most sophisticated, dense, complicated music you can, but you always have to maintain clarity as to what you're trying to say.
Right. Interesting segue, actually, just speaking about E.J. Pratt himself. This poetry is dense. As a composer, how do you deal with that? You know, so that you try to find this kind of balance between content, but at the same time, this clarity that's going to allow that content to be understood.
Yeah, it is very dense. It's, you know, really inspired by kind of the romantic poets, in a sense, the late 1800s, the English romantic poets. And so it's, not only is it dense with the number of words, but the language that's used
as well, too. Yeah.
Very archaic language in a sense that, you know, you might say. And, it's a style of poetry that has kind of got a little bit out of fashion now as well, too.
Right.
And that people would say maybe it's a little bit old-fashioned, right? But yet, there's something kind of about it which is always, about that which has always appealed to me. I wrote another piece a couple of years ago based on Alfred Noyes' The Highwayman, which is another example of this kind of ultra-romantic style of writing that Pratt followed as well. And I find there's something kind of magical in that text. Well, what else is archaic? Like, I mean, when you think of magic spells from Harry Potter or something, oftentimes that wonderful, delicious language, which we don't use anymore, comes out of this poetry, which is describing something I know very well, right?
Yes.
So whereas I might not describe the emerald glistening waters or whatever kind of thing of Newfoundland, I might say, it's pretty rough out there today, right? To kind of have this incredibly musical language. Now, the danger with that, of course, is if there's so much music in the language already, that it was a challenge. And it was a challenge because, again, like even when you read this poetry, sometimes you got to read it a couple times just to get the full meaning. So I think what is ultimately really clear and really important here, Stephen, is to just know what's being said at every single point. So that that the intention of it all can be clear. And then those fancy flowery words just become like ornaments. I think the other thing as well, too, when you're talking about dense text, is to kind of find the space.
Yeah. Right.
To find the space in between. And again, I love it when you're doing a project which that's so easily justified because space is a huge part of the ocean or being by the ocean.
Silence, moments of silence.
Yeah, exactly. So it's, again, like, whereas a lot of this romantic poetry, like The Highwayman's another good example, you know, it kind of goes da-dum, 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 da-dum. Like, there's a rhythm to the poetry that pushes on. And the last thing that that a composition teacher wants to hear their students say is that you're fighting against the rhythm of the piece. But there's no doubt about it that fighting is not the right word, but finding the contemporary way to set these pieces without just being dictated by the rhyme scheme or by the meter of the text, right? Because, mm-hmm. you know, again, if you're just going to kind of follow the meter of a quote unquote old-fashioned piece of poetry, you need to kind of always maintain the meaning of the text, but find your way of expressing it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I would say that's one of the things I appreciate the most, and even when I was working through it, kind of even just on my own, that there's an economy mm-hmm. in the writing that it, I appreciate so much, so that I always feel like there's never a note too many and never a note too few. Just kind of what is necessary to convey the moment in the moment. And that's not to say that we don't have moments where the music is extremely luxurious, but it's one of the things I think that you're just so good at.
There's a real tendency to overscore things and to overwrite.
Right.
And I mean, even with the orchestration that I'm working on in the opera right now, it's that I often find myself like slapping myself on the wrist and saying, "No, you don't need that extra string section, or you don't need those extra percussion." Like it's you try to write the place where the text and the story can have the maximum impact.
Yeah,
because it's so easy, and you see it all the time in new music as well too, to kind of go past that tipping point. So, but it's a struggle, and you fight against that, and kind of like and not overwriting.
Also, the textures you create are wonderful to sing with too, because if mm-hmm. when you overwrite, then the singers tend to have to sing forte all the time, and then
right.
you know, it's not
right.
doesn't always sound nice
yeah.
from the vocal perspective.
Yes,
and so you've given us some really wonderful places where we can pull right back,
yeah.
in the piano and the voice, and the impact is great. Like it's a
Well, and like that relationship with singers as well too comes from the
yeah.
amount of work that I've done in the opera field, because I
yeah.
really I love singers, and I've loved working with singers. You know, I want singers who are performing my pieces to be having fun.
Mm-hmm.
I want them to be enjoying what they're doing. It, you know, so some of the most gratifying things that comes for me is when I hear from coaches or people working on my pieces that you know the singers are really enjoying
mm-hmm.
it, or you know that's gratifying.
Because
mm-hmm. if you sound good. I said.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, and you jumped into this project knowing that it was Michael and I that you were writing for. I'm curious to know if that becomes a part of your compositional process, or whether you actually try to kind of remove yourself from that, knowing that Michael and I won't be the only people to perform this, ideally.
Right.
Right? So, yeah, so again, the question of balance comes into play. You know the performers that you're writing for, and yet you want to write a piece that any tenor could sing. How does that kind of influence process for you?
And it absolutely influences on both sides of it. I mean, both sides of the equation. It's very comfortable knowing that you're working with professionals of your caliber, in a
right.
sense, right?
Right.
Knowing that you were playing this, having worked with both of you, obviously.
Yes.
Knowing that you were going to be playing the premiere, knowing that I was writing for Michael.
Mm-hmm.
There's a comfort there. And you want to write a piece that has legs, as they say, or that can be performed again. But I've never written a piece that I didn't want to just get out there. I mean, the whole point of being an artist, the whole point of composing is to communicate with people. And I'd like to communicate with as many people as possible. So in writing a piece, absolutely, you want to write something that takes advantage of the standard. And again, I think working with so many singers and so many different voices over the years, I've got a pretty good sense
mm-hmm.
of what a voice can do, what a tenor can do, what a tenor, Michael, tenor was the biggest challenge.
Really?
I felt like sopranos and mezzos, well, I'm a baritone myself.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Those were all a little bit easier, but the operatic tenor is such a unique
mm.
beast.
Yeah.
Compared to, like, the choral tenor.
Yeah,
or
I know
what
you mean. I know what you mean.
So that was kind of the one that took me the most time at the beginning as well. Now, that being said, it's a real privilege to be able to work with individual artists and to write pieces that we share this moment, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, it'd be great if the piece goes on and gets performed, but ultimately as well, too, what I'm looking forward to is the premiere, or is the times that we hear you
mm-hmm.
guys sing this piece, right?
Mm-hmm.
And again, like I say, when you're working on a composer who's been dead for 200 years, there's no ability for something to kind of be tailor-made, you know? And
mm-hmm.
and listen, suits from Moores are fine and a little good and stuff, but everybody knows that a nice tailored suit is something special. What's absolutely amazing is the collaboration with the people that you work with, right? And the fact that as this compositional process has happened, we've been able to get together and I've been able to hear Michael sing through things and make suggestions, and yourself as well too. That's the magic.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the magic.
Mm-hmm.
I do 50% of the work by putting this little black dots on a page,
mm-hmm.
but it's not music until folks like you bring it off the page and turn it into music, right? Ultimately, what we'll come up with is something that hopefully gets done all over the
mm-hmm.
place by all sorts
mm-hmm.
of people. That's a benefit. The goal here is to write, to have a magical moment when we premiere this piece.
Right. I think it would be cool for our listeners to hear us talk a little bit about just kind of tracking the timeline of the whole process so they actually get a sense of how long it actually takes for something like this to happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, Dean, you and I met for coffee, and that must have been December 2017?
Yes, that's right.
Right?
Yeah, we had talked about things before.
Yes, but
this
that was kind
point.
Of the formal, yeah, like, exactly. Let's just sit down and talk about some of the particulars, kind of get our own timeline.
Yes.
So, I mean, that's, okay, so December 2017, and we essentially said, we'd love to have a score from you about a year from now.
Right.
And so you had a score to Michael and I think kind of end of November, mm-hmm. of last year. Michael and I had the opportunity to kind of just go through our parts on our own. Michael and I started meeting about a month ago. And one of the things I love about how CASP kind of approaches the whole notion of commissioning is that we kind of encourage this very robust dialogue between performers and composers. And so the three of us actually met for the first time in the room, and Lance Williford actually joined us as co-artistic director of Canadian Art Song Project. And I'd love to talk a little bit just about that kind of initial meeting where performer and composers are in the room for the first time, and kind of what we learned, what we discovered, what the joy of that is.
Yeah, well, I have to say it's a little scary because, the first time we met, we'd spent maybe a couple of rehearsals.
Yeah, I think we'd had two rehearsals.
And of course, I didn't know all the notes, so I was singing some wrong notes. And there's some really, really interesting sections that where the intonation is probably the main point that you're trying to get across. And I remember when we were doing it thinking, oh God, I'm not singing this right. But nevertheless, we plowed through. And it was an amazing experience, actually. And knowing Dean as I do, it wasn't particularly stressful because I knew that, you know, he's a good-natured guy. He'd be open to all sorts of things. But it was a very cool experience. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
I'm curious, Dean, what you're listening for, actually, because, you know, you've had this vision in your head, you've put it on paper, you've tried to be as clear as possible, and then you kind of get in the room with us and we're saying, Dean, what about this? Yeah. What about this? But what are you listening
and
for,
be honest,
actually?
Right.
You know,
right.
What kind of triggers you as you listen to kind of people putting your music together for the first time?
Well, I mean, it was funny as well, because I had mentioned as well, too. I think I was writing this other piece. Like, of course, I wrote the song cycle and then went back to working on this other project. And then I knew I was coming back to Toronto. I just moved to Kingston in June. But I was moving back to... I came back to Toronto for that, and it was like, I got in the car in Toronto, and I said, or in Kingston, rather, on the way back, and said, gee, I better start thinking about this piece again. It's been like a month and a half since I finished it. And now, I think I got in the room as well, too, and I said, you know, suddenly I'm a little nervous.
That made me feel a little better, actually.
Yes. There's no situation when the first time you hear something of your music performed that you aren't a little bit nervous about.
Sure.
Right? And you also wonder, it's like, oh, these guys got together before, like, what were they saying then, you know?
Uh-huh.
But I think I've come to trust myself a lot more than I used to when I was younger. And I think, and there's good reason for that, right? I'm teaching composition at Queen's University now as well. And I had a student that came in and she had written a choral piece. She'd never written a choral piece before, and a choir did a reading of it. And it wasn't what she thought it was going to. She was disappointed because it didn't sound like what she wanted it to sound like. And I kind of was there as well. And as a younger composer, that's the way you are. But as you start to kind of have this experience of hearing your piece for the first time or working with various, you start to trust yourself a little bit more.
Uh-huh.
There's no question there are times when I'm like, oh man, is the well going to run dry? And am I now writing it like a piece of garbage kind of thing?
Uh-huh.
Right? And there's plenty of times like that at 1 o'clock in the morning, you go to bed thinking that it's garbage. And then the next morning you get up and listen to it and say, that's not actually that bad. I think that's an important thing is kind of, I start to trust myself a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
So coming in, to hear this piece, hear you guys do this piece for the first time, really it was mostly exciting. Because again, that's the moment, right? You spend your time writing in the basement and either you love that because you're enjoying the process, or sometimes it's like, oh my gosh, I got so much work to do. And it's stressful. It can be stressful as well, like any career. Coming in to hear someone perform, someone who's worked hard on your piece for the first time, is that's a payoff. Like that's a real joy, right? Still, again, like I'm 47 years old now, and I still hear this going, "Oh my gosh, I wrote that." You have to kind of put that aside as well, too, but then start to listen critically,
right,
and listen analytically. Right?
Yes,
is something that's going wrong because of something I've written? Is it because the people who are performing it are not capable of doing it? you kind of have to tease out where what the real problem is. Sometimes, absolutely, is I've written something that doesn't make sense, right? Mm-hmm. Other times, it's like, just hold on, let them learn it a little bit, and then see where it goes. So it's kind of trying to identify, because then you could go ahead and end up changing everything just because they didn't know it well enough. And there is a perception, especially, you know, with young singers as well, too, is that if you can't sight read something, it must be written wrong, you know? Uh-huh. And I think that's, again, that's something as singers get older as well, too, and get more experience, they start, they gain those skills as well, too.
Sure. I think having time to live with the piece is really important.
Well, and there's lots of fantastic traditional, like, let's say, operatic or song rep that you can't sight read.
Yeah,
right?
Precisely, yeah.
And if it's by a composer named Schumann or by Wagner or something like that, you assume that it's you. But a lot of times when it's a new piece,
right.
Again, some people have the tendency to go, oh, this is just not well written. That's kind of, you know, and sometimes it isn't. But again, it's a question of all kind of working through it and sticking to it until you can really identify what the problems are.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, in case in point even with Michael and I working on this piece, when we first started working on it, there were moments that kind of, you know, light bulbs went on for both of us, and we thought, could we maybe rethink this, or should we talk to Dean about this little moment?
Right.
One of the things I loved about that first meeting is that you were so open to suggestion, but also I felt at the same time kind of firm when you felt that a suggestion maybe took the music out of its kind of intended effect or its vision. So can you talk about that a little bit too? Like, where is that line drawn for you as the composer?
Yeah.
Of trying to be open to suggestions that the performers might be trying to bring to the table.
Yeah.
But also being kind of true to yourself as the composer.
Well, no, exactly. And I mean, like, open, I think openness is, that's a huge word. Like, that's as any artist, and any artist needs to be incredibly open either to different styles or different suggestions, or I want you guys to feel incredibly comfortable doing what you're doing, right? But it's true. Like, I'm the one who's kind of dealt with this and lived with this for the longest time. When you start kind of saying this about this note or that note, I start to think, wow, I really have thought about every note in this. And in some cases, something which might just seem like a cast-off is like, no, I really did that for a very specific reason. Yeah. The Galleries of the Night
was
one example that, that the whole piece has this kind of, the accompaniment has this real syncopation quality to it. The suggestion you made sounds very musical and very cool, but it kind of, there was supposed to be a static quality.
To go against that.
To the individual. So, again, like, it's really fun to be in that workshop situation because it kind of forces you to
defend your choices.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
And in some cases, it's BS, but more often than not, it's a question of, no, I did. This is what I thought about this. I've been sitting in my basement working on it, so I've never had to voice it, right? And that's really great because having to to justify every moment, I think, makes the whole piece so strong. So it's not just note, kind of. It's not just an accompaniment and a vocal line.
Mm-hmm.
It is a really thought out piece that has intention in every moment.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, for me, one of the greatest gifts of a session like that, where we have you in the room, Dean, is just being able to ask you the questions that are on our mind. I mean, how often have I been slaving over, you know, a moment in Schumann, thinking, God, Robert, what were you getting at? You know, and just to have you here and to be able to say, you know, Dean, I can play this two ways. You know, and have you actually hear it and say, I prefer this one. This is what I was going for.
Right.
You know, just we were discussing some pedaling.
Yeah.
Some pedaling things. And were you going for this kind of long, sustained pedal where we do get a slightly murky effect by the end? Or do you prefer something a little bit more clean? And just to be able to have you in the room and to kind of... Because it just gives me even a greater sense of who you are beyond the page.
Right.
And for me, it's one of the greatest gifts of that time together.
I think what that does is it really makes, it's going to make this premiere something really, really special. But I also love the fact that you say, I can play it this way or I can play it that way.
Right.
Because ultimately, as I mentioned, I just put these black, I'm not belittling, obviously, the work of the composer is very important, but I create this piece of paper with ink on it.
Yeah, yeah.
But then artists have to bring it to life. And I love hearing things interpreted in different ways.
Right.
There's very few times, There have been examples. Yeah, well, sure. I'll admit that there's times when I've been sitting in one of my operas sweating, going, oh my gosh, this tempo is like so slow,
or, so wrong, yeah.
Or this is not kind of what I had in mind. I think right. I think good art needs to have the ability to be interpreted and taken in different directions. Mm-hmm. And another pianist and another tenor may take this piece mm-hmm. and do something different with it, and that's great.
Mm-hmm. Michael, question for you.
Sure.
Just because I know that you've actually premiered a lot of new music.
Mm-hmm. Quite a lot.
How do you approach the learning of a new score? You know, as opposed to something, you know, we can't go, there's no established practice. We can't go to kind of YouTube, even just to get a sense of what the piece is all about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're kind of looking at it for the first time, and we're the artists that are kind of breathing life into it, in a sense.
Yeah.
So how is it different for you? Or
The opportunity to create something new is really exciting. And you really can put your own stamp on it as a performer. I approach, in terms of learning notes, it's the same regardless of what I do. You know, I sit down at the piano and I'll sort of figure out the basic harmony of the bar and figure out the intonation of the pitches and
mm-hmm.
play the melody, repeat it mm-hmm. until I get it. And if there's a difficult part, I repeat it over and over again, and everyone in the house knows that part of the song because they all hear it over and over again.
Humming it in the shower.
Yeah, right. But I think, and I have done a fair bit of new stuff over the years, but it's, when you're doing something with people, and especially Dean, who I've never actually done something with a composer who I know quite as well as Dean, and there's a little, you feel a bit more responsibility to do a really great job for him. Do you know what I mean? When you've got somebody who's a friend.
Yes.
And also, because he wrote it for me, again, there's that added responsibility of really doing a great job on the piece. So I've spent a lot of time, and I've been very lucky because I've been home for the past month and really have been, you know, working on this very hard and have come to love this piece so much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And which is great because I feel almost a sense of ownership too, which is kind of cool when you know it's you've been writing it, and the chance to premiere it is so exciting. And working with Stephen too, it's really great. I think we've had a really wonderful time. It's a tricky piece. I mean, I will say it's tonal-ish. You know, when we talk about you talk about sort of some of the more avant-garde composing and composers, and I've done some of that stuff. In fact, right now I'm also working on a piece by Reimann. It's a German composer, and this piece is in that more avant-garde style. And so it's kind of interesting to be working on that and this at the same time. I love, there's so many moments. I think almost every single song has moments where I just, you know, have a smile every time I sing it or feel that great sense of joy, really. So I'm so excited.
There's always
to get
a center.
Yeah.
You know, even if there's a moment that might kind of stray a little bit, you know, it's like, okay, but I'm still feeling the pull to see. You know, it's like there's
but
always...
But sometimes you have to resist the pull to see.
No, yeah, right.
Which is, but that's what I love about this, too, is that it really challenges you as a performer. I mean, I feel like, you know, I've sung a lot of stuff, and but there's new things in here that I haven't done before.
Mm-hmm.
There's that one piece in particular where you, Stephen, and I are doing, it's essentially a recitative, and the piano and the voice are literally in unison.
Yeah.
Not harmonic unison, but rhythmic unison, and then there's all these incredible plush chords around me. And in a way, it's one of the most challenging parts of it for both of us.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, I think the impact of that particular movement will be something else. It's really cool. And then the way you I think that one is it right after that that we go into one of the most beautiful lilting songs of the whole cycle?
The Lullaby,
which is just gorgeous.
It's,
I mean,
yes.
It's... You know,
it's the penultimate song.
It is. It's amazing. And
it just kind of takes you to this.
You know how it's funny
place.
How in every song cycle they say, oh, there's that piece. Oh, that's the piece.
Yeah,
or something.
Right.
I don't know if, I mean, I think, personally, I think every single piece is that piece. I love, you know, there's something in every single one of them.
But that will be a moment for
is,
the audience, for sure.
I think,
yes.
Yeah, just
because of also
beautiful.
What comes before it.
Well, this would, and that's what
you know,
I mean.
There's
it
a
stands
certain
out.
Tension that
oh,
is.
Oh, an incredible amount of tension. And the piece itself is incredibly operatic too. I mean that's the thing that you've done that's so great, is that you've challenged the singer to basically use every tool in the toolbox.
Where
you need to be able to sing high pianissimo
pianistically
notes.
Too
is that right? Yeah. And it's which makes it a joy, and you can't, I mean, it's the kind of piece where I think you need to be focused every moment, because if you sort of Right. Become self-indulgent, which a lot of singers do. I think that you lose the through line, you lose the sense of what you're doing, and I think that really staying in the
moment is so
important.
There's also kind of this
important
rhythmic tenacity just can't lose, and I think that has been a really big part of the work that Michael and I have done together.
Finding
the way we kind of rhythmically feed off each other.
And the tempi, it's amazing how your tempi markings, there were times again where we were like, I don't know. You know, we would question the tempi markings in the early stages of rehearsal. But then as we did it more and started together, we're like, oh yes. You know, like you said,
it's becoming clear.
It's becoming clear. We're like, Dean was right all along. He knew what he was
through the fog.
Yes. No, but it's an amazing process, I have to say. It's
and in the end it's always been about letting text shine through.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
You know, kind of getting away.
Well, so
or
much
kind of working so hard on the technical aspects,
but
so that in the end they can actually recede, so that the text comes front and center.
For me, that's the key to good singing, is get out of the way.
No, right.
Because you know, whenever you're trying to do something as a singer, the audience misses it usually.
But there's a lot that has to happen before you can get there.
I know.
You know,
I know.
And
we're still doing it.
In
the midst of it.
That has been the
journey. I still have notes for Dean.
Right. That has been the journey.
Yeah.
For sure.
It's been a great journey, though. It's really been fabulous. Fabulous.
Morning, yeah. Well, I mean, the whole poetry cycle, really, the seven songs of the cycle, talk about the different faces of the sea, the different perspectives, old and gray at times, young, vibrant at times, murderous at times as well, too. So the idea from the opening of this piece and this kind of motif, which becomes something which comes back over and over again, is something that just points to the immenseness.
Old, old is the sea, today.
And what I love, Dean, is that at the end of the cycle, it comes back kind of in its retrograde, almost kind of in an inversion.
Of course.
Of itself.
Which is so cool.
Following the cyclical
quality
of it.
So amazing.
I mean, the other interesting thing here
almost
is that
like the coming in and going out of the tide. You know,
This first line as well, too. I think this first line is what sold me on doing this piece, because later we get like the this is not a sentence that you need a dictionary to understand. This is really minimalism compared to the rest of his text, and there's just when I saw that first line, I thought, I gotta write that. I gotta score that simple sentiment, which has so much weight to it. Mm-hmm. There's so much wisdom in it.
Oh, yesterday, blue-eyed and shadowless as a child's face, he had the promise of a luminous dawn. Though through its many after hours it bathed the sun to pour its flaming vintage on the ocean floor that by a conjurer's touch was turned to rarer treasures manifold, when jacinth, emerald, and sapphire band a fringe around a core of gold.
When I think of this piece, I remember being down in Twillingate, actually, which is where my grandparents on my mother's side used to live. As a young boy, I'd go down with my cousin Keith, and we'd roam over the hills, kind of, this is what we would do. And there were these kind of incredibly rocky bays that we would kind of go down to. It was so isolated. And there was just a heaving quality to the ocean. I remember, in fact, we were down there once, kind of sitting, looking into the water, and a whale came up right there as well. And this happens in Newfoundland as well. But there's this kind of incredible amount of power. The ocean has been described as a beast and a, you know, and almost a deity at times as well, too. So the idea at the beginning here was to create something which obviously has the movement of the up and down, the rise and fall of the tides as well, too, but something which uses the whole range of the piano to kind of reflect that immensity in the ocean, even when it's calm, even when it's calm.
Let's move to song number two, Masks.
Mask, and this is the one whenever you're doing something like contemporary music as well, too, another pitfall that a lot of young contemporary composers fall into is that everything tends to be so angsty and so a certain color, in a sense, right? Whereas I really love pieces that can have brightness in them as well, too, and contrast, right? And again, when you think of the ocean, you think of the horror of ships capsizing and people lost at sea, but you also think of the joy of the being at the beach, or the, you know, just the joy of
kids
the
playing, life, exactly, yeah.
Right? Yep. So Masks is a really great example of a piece which gives me the opportunity to do a lot of different things musically. It certainly has a little bit of the jaunty kind of Celtic. Michael, you as an Irishman, you appreciate
little
that
folk
as well.
Song, lilting folk
so
song.
So it's certainly got kind of the Newfoundland folk song feel to it as well. But it also, the text also talks a lot about the ocean being a juggler, or being a these various kind of different personas, in a sense, right? And obviously, being a theater guy myself as well, through the idea of masks has a tremendously whimsical. Mysterious, but kind of like playful quality to it as well. So I loved the fact that with this piece I could do something that was going to be really contrasting to a lot of what was coming later.
That's what I mean when I say that there's a little bit of everything in it. You know, you've got the immensity of the first piece, and then the lightness of this one, and then, yeah, it's really cool.
Should we hear a little bit?
What hidden stories I mean within these forms, O sea, should every hour changing to time yet changeless be? But thus hast thou not won what gods have played, thou prince of all the revels, in life's masquerade, life's masquerade.
The Destroyer.
Oh, yeah, this one's fun.
Well, we have left all lightness behind, I think, with this one. And, so The Destroyer, we've had, ocean as wise, wizened sage, we've had ocean as playful child and dancer, and I think, obviously, when people think of the ocean, it can be a destroyer as well, too. So, obviously, a very textural piece.
Very much kind of like a sound landscape.
Yeah.
And in fact, a story kind of really, in reading the text that Pratt had written here as well, so kind of a story came out of it, like a bit more of a personification. And there was almost this sense that the ocean was becoming someone that like a family member was speaking to or something. Almost like the ocean was an addictive personality, or an abuser, or an alcoholic or something like that. The poem is just talking about how the ocean can be horrible. Began feeling like this very intimate conversation between two people that kind of cared about each other, but about the inevitable. Almost like a wife speaking to her husband before he goes out to get drunk to follow the same, because again, oceans follow cycles. I mean, there are cycles of life and death. To me, this kind of personification came out of this. And so, in fact, I've written in the score for the singer, somewhat ambivalent, as if resigned to fate.
Yeah.
I think fatalism is something which is kind of common amongst people who live by the ocean. So it's almost like the singer is saying, I know what you're going to do.
Yeah, we know what's
going to
happen, yeah.
I guess I'll be here to pick up the pieces, but you're going to do it whether I say do it or not, you know. And it's nice as well, too, to be able to take a piece which has kind of, it's so immense that it's abstract. Against the ocean, it's hard to fathom. But without even me planning this, just became this intimate relationship.
Yeah.
Another great example, Wagner, the Valkyrie.
Yeah.
An immense, that's an oceanic piece.
Yeah, totally.
But it's about this relationship between a father and daughter.
Yeah. Right.
And to me, that's what sold that piece. Yeah. I think with this piece, the immensity of it just in a flash became this intimate and tragic connection.
Mm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. And can you talk about the piano writing?
Yeah. So again, this is something kind of that I've had to learn kind of going, throughout my career as well, too, is I talked about trust earlier. Mm. There's a tendency as well, too, that you've got to keep things going. You've got to keep things moving, right? The minimalists knew that that wasn't the case. Steve Reich, Philip Glass, that whole movement was about maintaining things and just being kind of being patient as well, too, right?
Yes.
And so this piece doesn't have an incredibly, like, it's got a big piano accompaniment to it, but it's there's a static and foreboding quality to it as well, right? And again, you just have to trust yourself. Like rolled octaves in the bass of the piano.
Mm-hmm.
How
this
long?
Tremolo.
Yeah, this tremolo. How long can you maintain that?
Yes.
And for not people to feel uncomfortable about it. But with this kind of music, you have to let it sit.
Yeah.
If that tremolo happened only for two beats, it would be meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to have that time where you just relax your shoulders and breathe into it. And this is something more that when music came out of the common practice period, and it wasn't all about harmonic development and kind of, you know, this movement from chord to chord to chord to chord.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it became more about, you know, trusting and being patient and kind of letting the piece play out in the time that it needs to play out.
Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, even though we have bar lines, I feel like the effect of it is almost as if they don't exist.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know, so that the quarter note becomes more about ratio than kind of the ticking of time.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a tremendous
so
amount.
The whole thing kind of breathes like a big lung.
Yeah.
You know, in a sense.
Yeah, and it's true there are bar lines there, but there's a tremendous amount of flexibility for
exactly.
you guys to
yes.
breathe.
Yeah,
into.
Yeah, yeah.
Once more.
Songs 4 and 5, it's interesting because we have Retreat Part 1 and Retreat Part 2.
Right.
Can you talk about that decision a little bit?
Yeah, so, you know, it's really important to me when you're working with a piece of poetry like this is to, I really like to avoid taking out any text or thinning things out.
Mm-hmm.
If you're working with another poet, then I think you really need to be true to that poetry, and I think that you really need to embrace that. But that doesn't mean there aren't places where you come up against challenges. And so in Retreat was a very long, so this is the fourth poem in this set of six, was a very long piece. And I felt to kind of make, also I didn't want to write a song cycle that had a 3-minute song, a 2-minute song, a 2-minute song, a 7-minute song,
mm-hmm.
you know. So you know, I thought about, well, how can I kind of thin this out? How can I make this? And like the when you have text that's very, very dense, the last thing you can do is just do it fast.
Yeah.
I'll get through it quickly by kind of doing this text very fast.
Right.
So when I looked at it a little bit closer, I realized that there was a shift in the mood about halfway through the text, which enabled me to kind of turn that one poem into two songs that, of course, led into one another
mm-hmm.
beautifully because they were part
mm-hmm.
of the same piece,
mm-hmm.
but really allowed me to kind of shift the music to like it's like saturation, or to kind of make a greater contrast between the intention of the first part of the poem and the second part of the poem
mm-hmm.
as well. And it really is a piece that this piece, Retreat, reflects the kind of the ramifications of what's happened. The ocean, what the ocean has done, or what this character represented by the ocean has done on this night out or whatever. And so it's not just the retreat from the, I mean, you could think of the ocean retreating after a tsunami or something and pulling back. It's also that fugitive, that this character who's done this tragic thing,
mm-hmm.
fleeing, you know,
mm-hmm.
in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we talked about, you know, the E.J. Pratt, there's the colonial quality to it and an English quality to it. And so when I read the phrase about the Arab measure of this guilt, I had to figure out what that meant because I thought, uh-oh.
Yeah, I know. I thought the same thing when I first read it. Yeah.
So I kind of looked it up, and it basically was just a measurement. Obviously, the Arabic world was huge in creating mathematics and science and all this
stuff.
So in seafaring, an Arab mile is different from obviously what we consider a European mile.
Right.
So it's a certain amount of distance that was often used in shipping as well too,
okay.
Right? So Arab measure is a specific reference to that.
Great. Well, let's hear a little bit of Retreat Part 1.
Now like a fugitive upon the desert sand, a moment broods upon the life he split. And with a furtive gaze, circling the dusky ruin of his hand surveys.
Retreat Part 2. Probably the most challenging for me.
Yeah, right? Me too.
I feel like I'm learning Messiaen.
Okay, right. This is the second part of that of the poem Retreat, and whereas the first part really implied the sense of a fugitive fleeing, this part felt very much like a judgment. Mm-hmm. And so the character almost becomes a judge, and it has the weight of a judge. This piece essentially is a judge pronouncing judgment on the ocean or on the person who has done these transgressions, and the piano is then the weight of that voice. Is that the weight of that sense?
Yeah, it's very cool. When I was saying earlier how there's stuff I've never actually done before, this is something I don't think I've ever encountered before in this sort of recitative with piano. In rhythmic unison,
right.
It's really cool.
And Stephen, for you normally as well too. When you do recit, you play a chord.
The
singer does their thing, but you have to be. You guys
I'm
have to be
mirroring.
One being.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, it's tricky that way because we have to breathe it together
Oh,
what a tumultuous sea! Thy waters walk a liturgy. For thou dost take the
something completely, the antithesis. We have reborn.
Yeah, and again, it was a question of the ocean can change on a dime, and I, with this piece, we get to play with all those different colors. And after the density and the heaviness and the tragedy of what we've had, there's a beautiful this piece is still the aftermath of the tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
But there can be a calmness and there can be a beauty in that as well too, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the same way that people in a dysfunctional relationship, like a couple where one person is an addict or is an abuser, there's still so oftentimes some connection or there's some kind of there's it's not always darkness, there's an eeriness to this piece. We know that it's going to happen again, but there's a moment to breathe. And sometimes in a tragic life or in a busy, hectic life, small moments to breathe are invaluable.
A nice
sing
a pretty
tune.
Yeah.
And then we close with The Dead Calm.
Yeah, and this, I mean, this piece as well too points at Pratt was a minister, was an ordained minister before he became a professor here at U of T. And so there is a lot of religious imagery here as well too, and the idea of this kind of pontiff or the this last piece almost has kind of a hymn or a church-like quality to it, which I think again has been attributed to the ocean by many artists over the years as well, right? So the cycle now comes fully around again, which is why at the end of the piece we hear the inversion of what we heard at the very beginning,
and even just snippets. Mm-hmm. You know, we start with but then it settles kind of in this pulsating, steadiness.
Very cool. Right. Yeah, this is certainly a reflection, a very kind of spiritual for Pratt, Christian, but it doesn't have to be Christian. Mm-hmm. It's a spiritual look at what the ocean, I guess, what the ocean giveth and what the ocean taketh away. But again, with this inevitable return to the cycle of the ocean, the cycle of life and death, all reflected within the cycle of these poems.
Close today by thanking Michael and Dean for being with me to discuss the piece, the process, and we'll close just by letting you all know that if you are interested in hearing the premiere of Dean Bury's Sea Variations, that it will happen at the Richard Bradshaw Amphitheater as part of their free noon hour series on May the 22nd. We hope to see you there.